Today on Movie Wallahs, we talk about day 4 of our trip to the Tribeca Film Festival 2015. It's time for Movie Wallahs. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And Yazdi as well.
Movie Wallahs is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news, and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming, or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you. Greetings all.
Hello.
Hi.
So, this is really potentially our final main podcast here from Tribeca. We have been, I think we've done 3 episodes so far direct here from the festival, and today we're going to cover the final 3 films that we've watched. If we, depending on schedule and availability, we may sneak our way into another movie, in which case we'll cover that in a future podcast. But we thought we would just do this kind of final kind of wrap up from the film festival and give you a download of what we saw today. So I guess without further ado, we'll jump into the first movie of the day, which was Anesthesia.
Okay, so Anesthesia is directed and written by Tim Blake Nelson, and he also stars in the movie. So this is really how it's described, is a haunting meditation of city life that traces a chain of events that precipitate a brutal attack on a Columbia University professor. And it's got a really nice cast, including Sam Waterston, Kirsten Stewart, Glenn Close, and Corey Stoll. So, Yazdi, what did you think of this one?
Gosh, this movie was made for me. This is my kind of movie. It's smart. It's resolutely intellectual. It's unpredictable for the most part. And, you know, it's kind of like Crash, but maybe not as intense. But it's about these different stories who kind of all come together. And it's, you know, with the kinds of things it deals with, it could have been consistently shrill, and it's not shrill. It only gets very dramatic in its final moments. And gosh, there's stuff in the movie that even, like, references that even I didn't get. So I like the fact that it's not ashamed of being super intellectual, but it's just a fun movie, very well acted, plotted together. There's nothing amateurish or silly about it. This is a fine, polished, you know, piece of work.
Joe?
Yeah, I mean, almost my sentiments exactly. I wrote down during my notes, as we will have the movie, you know, what a beautifully crafted film this was. In particular, I think there were, you know, some very brave directorial decisions in terms of, you know, really the opening sequence is something that happens much mm-hmm. further on in the story. And so, you know, it kind of sets a scene where it's almost kind of like setting up dominoes, because you know what's going to happen mm-hmm. here. But at some point during the movie, they decide to push the dominoes, and all of these things kind of come together in a way that you know how it's going to end, but nonetheless the build-up is nonetheless dramatic and exciting as it would have otherwise been. It's a very confident directorial piece here. I'm not familiar with Tim Blake Nelson's other work, but certainly the level of confidence on show here in terms of how he sets up a shot. For example, the opening credits are you know, almost a 3 or 4 minute long shot of a green, you know, fruit and vegetable grocer in New York, and they play and life just happens in front, but there's nothing of story or plot going on.
But it's very confident. But it takes a lot of...
It was very confident, and I sat there and I was like, why is this interesting? And nonetheless, I was somehow transfixed. So, you know, overall, just a very, very well-crafted movie, and I enjoyed this one tremendously.
So Tim Blake Nelson, way more known for his acting. I'm just looking up his IMDb right now as we're speaking. He's done a ton of TV and movie, and less directing. I agree with you both. This is probably, I think, the most polished movie of the mm-hmm. entire film festival that we've had access to. This is the opposite of Applesauce that we talked about in the last podcast, for many reasons. But yeah, absolutely, this weaving together of many characters who are revealed over the first 6 or 7 scenes, and how that story all weaves together, you know, brings things like Crash, like Babel together. You don't quite know where it's going and how they're all going to connect, but you know they're going to, right? Because that's the type of movie this is. Great dialogue. I would just say the only issue I had with it was the smart-talking kids. That didn't quite resonate with me, but I like the stories and I like what it's trying to do. I think that it's examining life itself. It's asking all these existential questions that are highlighted by this lecture that's going on in the background by this Columbia University professor. And I think that that's almost the exposition for what's happening in the story. But normally where that exposition would really piss me off or irritate me, this didn't. I think it was a lovely backdrop for the rest of the movie. So absolutely very, very, very good.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, I think there could be some people who will just write this off as intellectual, you know, intellectual masturbation. Yeah, because there's a lot of gobbledygook, you know, but it all works. It all really worked for me. And I think unless you shoot for the big themes and even come up empty-handed, you know, what's the point of just, you know, being on the ground? Might as well shoot for the big themes. And, you know, there's such lovely actors. Sam Waterston, who plays Glenn Close's husband, you know,
lovely.
He's so good in that role, so believable. Kerry Stoll is so good. I mean, you know, these are actors who have very little to play with in their individual scenes, but really bring it on. And I like that even within the genre of movies which have interconnected stories, the way this one is constructed, it's made up of very, very short scenes, you know. It's not like chapters, you know, it's not like one chapter in this, another chapter in this, and then everything comes together. All these stories are constantly interlocking and they're little short. They're not constantly interlocking, but the movie's constructed with these interlocking scenes, very short scenes of these different characters. And you kind of find out towards the end how they're all connected. And so it's kind of almost building this Jenga. It's building this little tower.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the tower holds up really well. I mean, because Each of those stories have a conflict, but I can say maybe half of those conflicts I didn't see coming. It kind of slowly opens each card one at a time. So that's really very nicely done. This is a very, you know, gifted writer. And by the way, Tim Blake Nelson has directed a lot of movies. He's been in hundreds of movies. But if people haven't watched, they should watch a movie called The Grey Zone, which is on Netflix, which he has directed several years ago. It's one of the best war movies ever made. It's just heartbreaking, unwatchable, but you know, he's done good stuff. And then I do want to talk about the cast, but let's see if you guys...
Yeah, I mean, you know, you've got a lot of the points that I had here in my notes. I mean, I think what was really nicely done here was the unique voice that every character had in the movie. And you talk about the way that the movie is edited with these kind of independent scenes. I mean, it was always surprising to me how many of these little stories were playing out in terms of their own individual unique narratives that, you know, we would come back to one and I'd actually forgotten because I'd then become so invested in some of the other stories that were playing out. It's like, oh my gosh, I can't, you know, yes, there was this situation happening here. So again, it was very well edited in that it was not difficult to keep track of what was going on, despite the number of these little stories that were playing out and despite how, you know, half an hour would go between, you know, certain segments of certain stories, which is a long time in a movie theater while you're being bombarded with kind of other information to remember where you were. But the characters were all so well drawn and crafted that you did always understand exactly, you know, the situation for all of them. And I think I was empathic with just about everyone in the movie.
Yeah, and the suspension of reality in this one was really good. I mean, I know we're watching a film and I know we're watching a work of fiction, but I really felt like we were looking into people's lives, and I liked the themes that it covered. It covered an enormous number of themes. The other thing that really impressed me is there's an actor in this film called K. Todd Freeman, and he plays the character Joe, who is a crack addict. That is one of the best crack addict performances since Samuel L. Jackson in Jungle Fever.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, there's
brilliant.
The guy from The Wire as well, but
yeah, okay. The Wire was you know, something else, and they had a whole couple of seasons to
build on,
play that up. But I'm saying from a film performance, this performance was as good as Samuel L. Jackson in Jungle Fever for me.
Just before we go to the other performances, I know, yes, you want to talk about that, but that whole crack addict thing was, I think, my only real nitpicking disappointment, because it felt a little just...
stereotypical.
Cliche.
Very stereotypically cliche, yeah. It's exactly, you know... I understand. I mean, there are social issues. It's set in New York, and there are cultural barriers and cultural differences, but why did we have to have the same crack addict, you know, down on his luck, you know, black guy here. I mean, you know, there was a nuance to his character that perhaps was a little less stereotypical, and I won't talk about it. But just, again, a minor nitpick, but in a movie that it almost felt like the movie had to have some kind of racial diversity in it. So they were like, here you go. We'll have this little sideline. So I don't think it was meant that way, but it could be construed as coming that way. And I think the movie will be in for some criticism when it gets out there into the review circles, because people are going to go, really? And I think for some people, that's going to be enough to kind of detract from the rest of the movie experience. So performances, yes, you wanted to talk about performances.
Everybody's so good in this. Corey Stoll is so good. And his wife, it's Mickey Sumner. She's Sting's daughter. She was the best friend in Francis Ha.
Oh.
I don't know if you remember.
Yes.
That was her. Everybody's so good. But Gloria Rubin is in it, Gretchen Mol, all these people, they're so good. But, you know, Kristen Stewart, you know, she gets, I think, probably the weakest roles of all of them. But I don't know, now seeing her, you know, in Clouds of Sils Maria recently, she's one of the few actors now. She's really coming onto her own, and she's picking these roles where she plays this very intelligent but very broken person.
But she's always broken.
Yeah, but I think she's one of the few actors who can bring that intelligence to, you know, she seems, and I thought she was marvelous in this, considering how small the role was and how probably the most underwritten character in the whole story. I think she was good. She was very good.
I found her quite annoying, to be honest.
But she's
Again, so typecast, and every time she comes on screen, I'm thinking, when are you going to cry? And lo and behold, there come the tears. So for me...
she's typecast, for sure. And I think ultimately it's why you hire Kristen Stewart. It's you almost visualize the kind of the stereotypical depressed early 20-something / teenager. She has, sorry, Kristen, if you're listening to this, but she has that kind of face that just seems so tortured and pained without saying a word. And I think she does this kind of work really well. And, you know, yes, it's disappointing that we're not seeing more range from her, but I did feel for her in this movie in a way that I think I could have been easily annoyed by.
Yeah, but Kristen Stewart could easily be doing stupid horror movies or stupid romantic comedies, or, you know, I admire her for the fact that she's kind of, you know, she's more, you know, she's trying to do different stuff. And I think that's,
she's making good movie choices, just perhaps not good character choices. You know, again, like we were talking about January Jones in the last episode, it's like I'd like to see her do something just a little different, just a little more of a stretch for her as an actress, because I think she's capable of doing good work, but not.
But I can't think of any other contemporary younger 20-something actors who I would hire and have convincingly be a graduate student. Like,
no,
I believed
you're right.
That she was doing her PhD.
You're right.
You know, everybody else comes off, I don't know.
Yeah, no, like, I agree with
you. Like Chloe Grace Moritz. I wouldn't believe her for a minute that she's a super smart graduate student at Columbia. But anyway.
Yeah, I forget which director said this, but it's very easy to fake a lot of things in Hollywood, but intelligence is not one of them.
That's right.
You know, a dumb actor cannot play an intellectual individual. It never flies.
Channing Tatum?
Exactly.
What are you saying? I love Channing Tatum. Leave him alone.
I love Channing Tatum too. I'm just saying.
But even Glenn Close, right? She has nothing to do in the movie, but somehow she becomes the heart of the movie in a way.
Yeah.
The emotional.
I love that couple.
Yes.
Oh my God.
See, this is what good actors do. They have three scenes together.
Yeah.
Glenn Close and her husband, and you completely, absolutely believe in them.
That's almost forms the foundation of the movie.
Yeah. That's movie magic. Anyway, not to make too much of it.
Okay, great movie.
People Move go watch on. Anesthesia.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Hopefully this will get a release. I think it will. Clout and competence that I think this is one that will certainly make the rounds. There will be opportunities to see this outside of the film festival circuit. All right, moving on to movie number two then, which is Cartel Land. So Cartel Land is another documentary. So we described one documentary that we saw yesterday called The Diplomat. And Cartel Land is essentially set around two separate locations. One is in the southern part of the USA, where you have essentially a group of people who have become fed up with some of the situations regarding the drug cartels and immigration. They feel that the border is inadequately protected, and so they've taken things matters into their own hand and set up almost like a vigilante group to go and do the job that they feel that Homeland Security is not doing. The flip side of that is on the other side of the border, not necessarily immediately over the border from Mexico, a little further deep down, but there is an area of Mexico, the name of which escapes me right now, but there has essentially been a loss of control by the authorities to the drug cartels. And a group of people in this state down in Mexico have taken matters into their own hand. They've formed a group known as the Autodefensas, or Autodefensas group.
Self-defense
group. And they've armed themselves, and they've actually taken the war to the cartels by actively seeking them out within communities and expelling them from certain towns in a way to try and get back control, which has led to certain political difficulties because, you know, they themselves in some ways are in direct contravention of the law, but they feel that there's no other way to kind of protect their families from cartel violence. So a lot of issues at play in this particular documentary. Guys, what did you think of this?
Okay, so I'm probably the one who loves the documentaries in the group. Although I felt educated by this, and I think it's an important story to be told, as far as documentaries go, it's not one of my favorites. I actually had a bit of a snooze in the middle, so I kind of lost interest, plus we haven't had much sleep.
Well, let's just be clear about this. Was it was it the documentary in terms of the filmmaking, or was it the fact that you were just completely burned out at this point in the film festival?
I think the former, Joe. I think that the pacing was a little bit off for me. I felt like we spent too much time with one point of view. I did like the fact that it's giving the vigilantes on both sides, right? So we have two sets of vigilantes fighting a war, and there's that whole ethos of, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. I thought that's where it was going to go, and it didn't quite go there, but it tried to meld those two things together, I thought. And then I liked this central character, but then he turned out to be a bit of a rascal. So I don't know. It didn't. Do you know what I'm saying?
I think
the pacing was kind of off, and I feel like it should have been a little bit tighter. I don't know what message it was giving. I feel like it missed the mark a little bit on a point of view. And I was thinking, there you go. I was looking for a point of view.
I mean, I know exactly what you mean, because I'm very, very conflicted about this movie. I really don't know what to make of it. And to be honest, I was questioning. So there's a lot of stuff which happens in this documentary,
yeah,
which makes me question, how the hell did they ever get access to this?
Okay, yes.
So there's things happening here, real shootouts. They're following people as people are trying to, you know, these vigilantes, as they are, you know, going out in open warfare, and people are being shot and bullets are firing. And I'm like, how the hell did they ever get access to it? Which I hate to bring up, but it almost, at some points, I was questioning if some of what we were seeing was staged. And at some other point in the movie, I thought if this particular movie was made as kind of propaganda for this Autodefensas, because it's really trying to make the case that, you know, the government in Mexico is so far gone and the police are no different from the drug cartels. And so, you know, the people have to stand up on their own rights, and they're almost...
Well, at one point, they're almost claiming they're one and the same. That many
well, later
people
on,
are,
so it's almost lionizing this group of, you know, revolutionaries who are taking the power back and fighting against the cartels. But then it kind of flips on that as well. So it has, and maybe that's the strength of the movie, and I'm not seeing it, is that it's just saying that things are really fucked up, you know, and that there is no moral right or wrong, and there is complete ambiguity, and everybody who comes from a good place and a good desire to do something, you know, ultimately also gets corrupted. Maybe that's the point of the movie. But I was very conflicted through the whole movie, and I still don't know what to make of it. It's certainly no the act of killing. It's not that.
Right.
Not even
well,
close to that.
Hey, whoa.
Yeah.
Because that's, I think you guys have both been partaking of some of the cartel's product here, because Honestly, this is as powerful a documentary for me as The Act of Killing was.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this is Oscar territory for me. I mean, clearly for me, this is going to be among the highly regarded documentaries at the end of the year. This was fascinating on so many different levels. I think the one thing that I think was a little frustrating for us as viewers is that it doesn't take a stance. I think it portrays both sides of each argument. I think it doesn't especially go out there, I think, to judge any specific party. I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of political viewpoints which play into, for example, the people who are north of the border, right? The US people who have taken it into their own hands to go out there and they're very easily judged. If you come from one particular political persuasion or another, you automatically have an opinion about these people which is locked in. And yet the movie didn't take one side or the other in my mind. I think it portrayed them almost sympathetically at times, but also showed them to be, you know, potentially, you know, bigoted and you know, they
pseudo KKK.
Well, you know, yeah. I mean, I think that does that well. Similarly, with the situation south of the border, I think you know, you can see that any kind of power in any situation where there isn't true law and order lends itself to corruption. You can see the well-intentioned vigilantes going out there, but then their techniques over time can be corrupted because, you know, you're getting people into some sort of position of power, and without a true moral compass, they lose that sense too. I mean, they became as thuggish as the cartels in some of the arrest sequences. And then, you know, it goes into deeper issues of, well, you know, what happens when you legalize these groups? You know, then, you know, the corruption of the cartel and the power. It just shows you, like you say, Yazdi, how effed up this whole situation is. And I left the movie with kind of a general sense of hopelessness. I mean, I don't see a path forward, and I don't think the movie saw a path forward. But I think it was important for me as a viewer to kind of understand that these issues are very, very deep, ingrained, entrenched, and complex. There is no simple solution to what's going on in Mexico and how it affects the United States and how the United States affects Mexico. There's no overnight kind of, well, if I vote for this particular political party, they'll take care of it, because it's just not going to happen.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Joe. I think it did cover all of those things. And like I said, I did come away feeling educated about some of the things I didn't know about. I guess it started off as a Breaking Bad, the documentary, right? So we start off with these Mexican meth cookers who are basically the moral, you know, that they almost have morals about it, right? We know we're doing something bad, but we're trying to make a dime. And, you know, really it's the US's fault because they're the ones who need it. And we're just trying to fill a need. And so, you know, hey, isn't capitalism great? And then we kind of go into this, you know, this story about this doctor, you know, I mean, my God, he's a physician, and he's inspiring these towns to take back their towns from these really scary cartels who are like killing their families. And by the way, there's some really graphic footage of severed heads and hanging bodies and people being killed. I was shocked that that's even made it through.
But this is the reality of life down there.
No, I know that, but I'm surprised that that's even made it through the
It was necessary.
The sensors, right?
It was necessary. Absolutely necessary.
Agree.
For us to understand what these people are dealing with in their world.
But then it just kind of like meanders a little bit, and then that doctor really bothered me. I mean, I was like, really? He's only human.
We can debate the content of this for hours. I mean,
correct.
It's not that he's only human, but I think, again, it speaks to the nature of politics and power and the kind of people that rise to power within any organization.
Yeah, true.
You know, within any, you know, Martin Luther King is a great example of somebody who was, you know, driven but also flawed as an individual. And I'm not comparing him at all, so please don't misquote me on that. But nonetheless, this person, I think, had some genuine ideas about how to resolve a situation where they were hurting. And of course, he, you know, it shows that he's not himself perfect, but
I just question again, how the hell did they get access to this?
I think they went down to tell a particular story, and this story emerged. Because I don't think you can set out to get the kind of thing that they got.
Because why would the doctor ever agree to be filmed in this particular light? Maybe he at one point was thinking that this would be the film which will show the West about the good that his organization is doing.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, he agrees to be shown in pretty bad light. And I don't know
that he signed off on that. I mean, I think, like a lot of great documentaries, the cameras are just rolling and these people forget that the cameras are there. I mean, whoever they had who had access to their organization was part of, you know, their daily life. And I think that particular, I know the moment you're speaking about when he's in the car, right. When he was talking to that young girl, I can only think that was a moment of, you know, just ego a little bit out of control and him just forgetting that the cameras are rolling. Because I agree, I don't know that he would have ever signed off on that, but I don't know that he had any control. And we know at the end of the movie, you know, what his current situation is. So I don't know that he would have any, you know, legal right to prevent this footage being shown.
And there must have been like 20 ambush scenes in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, and if those are not staged, then my God, this, give him the Best Director Award right now, because he was probably putting himself at incredible risk through all of this. Because
that's why I think this movie is mind-blowing. See,
that's why I think I kind of question the morals of what kind of... who sold their soul to be able to get access to this? Because it seems altogether improbable that you would get this kind of access without doing something morally snaky. But anyway, we can talk about this for a while.
I mean, for me, that's the mark of a good documentary. It's thought-provoking on absolutely every level for me. So, you know, as far as a wrap-up goes, I will be very surprised if this is not among the Oscar contenders by the end of the year, because it hit everything perfectly for me. And I'm going to be thinking about this for days, weeks, months. It's a fascinating work and a fascinating look at some very difficult situations. So, you know, big thumbs up for me.
Hmm. Final movie.
So the final movie we saw today is Come Down, Molly, and it is by first-time director Gregory Corn, and it tells the story of Molly, who is a new mother, has a little infant, and she spends most of her day taking care of her little infant, and then it's clear that she's struggling with being a good mother, and it's taking a tremendous toll on her, and quite unexpectedly, she decides to take a break because she's overwhelmed by spending all the time with this little infant, and almost on a whim takes off to spend a day or two with her high school friends who she hasn't met in a long time and who have gotten together in this mountain retreat. And the rest of the movie plays out in terms of her experiences meeting with her old high school friends. Most of the actors are first-time actors, including Eleanor Hendricks, who plays Molly. This is a very unusual movie, and I'm sure we will all have much to say about it. But do either one of you want to start off with your opinions, Rashmi?
Okay, so this is my least favorite movie of the entire film festival. And what's interesting to me is that we spend a lot of time just walking through nature, but Molly is a colloquial term for a type of ecstasy, and clearly this is a psychedelic experience. And so Come Down, Molly is a term that's used when people come off the down from
high.
And apparently when you take too much ecstasy, you can get depressed. So that kind of sums up how I felt after this movie. I really didn't enjoy this. I didn't get it. It didn't resonate with me. I didn't care about the characters. I felt like everything was underwritten. I think in the Q&A, we realized that there were 2 days of improv where there was no script and we just followed everyone around through nature. Awful movie.
Joe.
So, yeah, I mean, this movie has a very improvisational feel again. You know, a lot of these early film makers use that style, I think, in part to... You know, it eases things when you can just shoot a lot of footage and cut the bits that kind of work rather than having everything planned out to a T. You know, there's what's interesting to me about this movie is that nothing really happens for the first 45 minutes or so. And I did look at my watch. It really takes its kind of time. It's a very experimental movie. I mean, I think, you know, clearly this is...
No pun intended.
Clearly this is kind of, you know, somebody taking a shot at a style of filmmaking that is... Again, I used the term earlier on, you know, guerrilla filmmaking, but I really feel like they were, you know, a bunch of friends who got together and made a movie. But nonetheless, there was something very engaging to me about this movie. It was more of a feeling than a story. Mm-hmm. And I think what struck me, and I must admit, it took a while for me to get there, but what struck me somewhere between 45 minutes and an hour into the movie was just that there's a certain truth to everything that we were seeing. There's a truth about the friendships, there was a truth about the dialogue, there was a truth about the characters. It just kept, that word just kept playing on me. So I normally hate this kind of thing, but I actually found this to be a more than averagely engaging piece of film. Fascinating. I don't actually understand my response to this movie.
Yeah, because that's interesting.
This isn't the kind of thing that I normally like. And maybe some of the mushrooms that were consumed on screen somehow floated over through the celluloid into my psyche.
So I think the true, you know, academic movie lovers believe that non-narrative film is the best kind of film there is. And I think within the non-narrative form, I think this is one of the better examples I've seen. I mean, as I've said, I think I'm just glad that this too is what cinema can be. You know, yeah. I say this very often. Yeah. It's just amazing to me. I think ultimately, and in a way I wish I hadn't watched or listened to the Q&A afterwards, because I kind of had my own feeling, is I think they were going for a very hypnotic, meditative feel through mm-hmm. the whole movie. And I think this kind of, at first I was kind of struggling. Well, you know, at the halfway point, I was like, well, clearly this is going to be a movie where nothing happens. And this is a movie where,
and you're right.
where nothing happens. But then in a way...
That was the point.
That's the point. And it's going for a state. And I mean, not to make too much of this movie, but I think the message it might be saying is that maybe we are all so stupid in trying to solve our real problems, you know, by all kinds of, through material means, through building better relationships, through working out and being healthy and seeing therapists and yoga and exercising and biking and all this stuff. But maybe this movie is saying that maybe the solution to all our problems is just getting away for a few days and being one with nature, maybe with and without the help of, you know, certain hallucinogenic substances. And maybe it'll kind of cleanse your soul. And maybe I'm making too much out of it, but, and I agree that middle half of the movie is just people being in this trance-like state. And it kind of is like the Tree of Life in a way.
Right.
You know,
Terrence Malick popped to mind as I was thinking about this, because the imagery is very powerful.
Mm-hmm. I'll give you that. The cinematography is beautiful, but how can you be in that part of the US and not get amazing footage? I mean, it kind of does the work for itself.
Well, that's not fair.
that's actually very unfair, Rashmi, because I mean, I think it's like saying, you know, let me give you a camera and see if you can take a terrible picture because you're in Yosemite. I mean, of course you can take a lousy picture in Yosemite, but it doesn't mean to say that the place is
no,
to blame.
I mean, like I said, I was giving credit to the cinematographer, but I mean,
this can be a very frustrating experience, and it was a very frustrating experience until I surrendered myself to it. And I also like the idea. One of my favorite writers of all time is Anne Tyler, and she writes lots of books. But she wrote a book about a woman who is very successful and who's very, you know, she's the wife to a very successful man. They have grown kids. And for no explanation, one day she just packs her bags and leaves, and she goes to another small town and starts living her life. And the whole novel is about her setting up a new life, and it never explains why she walked away from a previous life.
Right, but Wild is that movie, right? Wild is really, really good version of someone who decides to do something because their life is fucked up and they want to experiment and they want to get away from it all, right? That's a movie with a purpose that's acted really well and you get from somewhere to somewhere else. I didn't see any arc in this movie.
I think it's more subtle than that.
Yes.
In Wilde, she had a pretty strong motivation to do what she has. This person is very well adjusted. In fact, this movie is about privileged people. It's very, you know, first world problems. Privileged people who have everything but are still unhappy.
Yeah.
And, you know, she is that person. She has all the privileges, but she's inherently unhappy. And I think sometimes you have to explore what the other option might be. What if you hadn't done A and pursued B? And I think it's a meditation on she allows herself those 24 hours to see what might be.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much into this movie.
No. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I think I came to that conclusion myself at the end of the movie. And it was reinforced by something that, you know, was said during the Q&A, which is, this character Molly has essentially gotten everything that she's wished for in her life. It's just she's struggling with the reality of, you know, childcare, of being, you know, a stay-at-home mom. I mean, evidently she's able to, you know, financially be at home with her child, but she's wrestling with some of the way that makes her feel. And you know, her solution to that is, you know, to give herself a break. And again, I think some of the moments towards the end of the movie where, you know, there are some very touching kind of moments which are done without dialogue. And the whole movie is very sparse on kind of it. Exposition type dialogue. I mean, a lot of what is said in the movie doesn't advance the plot in any way, but it creates a feeling, a sense of place, a sense of being. Obviously, this didn't work for you, Rashmi.
There was no plot to advance.
So she goes out and spends a day with seven other high school friends, right? Or friends of friends. What I liked about the movie is it never gives you the backstory about those seven other men. And you can say maybe because they didn't bother to write a plot. I think it would have been too easy to say, well, she had had an affair with this one and, you know, she kind of always liked this fellow's brother and they had broken up. And it kind of almost is above all that.
But I think the director was also, right, he said it himself in that, you know, he wanted to very much recreate a time when he did go out into the wilderness with his friends, take drugs, and they had this, you know, amazing kind of connected experience. And I think in some ways he's written the rest of the movie around that, you know, he wants the movie to give you that feeling that he had with his friends being together, stoned out of their brains. It's kind of like, you know, I mean,
be careful what you say now, Joseph.
I know, right? But it's kind of like, I mean, you know, you remember, I'm going to quote Rashmi and I's youth, but, you know, when we used to go out and we used to go to those parties in Ibiza, you know, those clubs, and you'd dance the whole night away, and you would have a certain feeling of
disconnect,
but they were very, we look back on those memories very fondly, almost more fondly than they were at the time, but nonetheless, they were very, you know, key elements of our youth and of who we are. And I would imagine if the world was getting down around me, to try and revisit an experience like that would be something that I would want to do. And I think that's all this movie was trying to do. It was trying very hard to create that feeling. I think the character of Molly was kind of grafted onto that as, you know, giving us some narrative to follow along. But more than anything, I felt he was putting us in a time and place. And he did that really well.
Okay, so clearly lost on me.
One other point. I mean, I think this movie, in some ways, and this is going to sound really awful and pretentious and nonsensical, but in some ways, this movie had a European style feel to totally. It. And I think had it been done in a language that I didn't understand with some subtitled dialogue, I think somehow it would have felt like higher art than it came across, because we were seeing a bunch of, 30-something young Americans, because they're, you know, that age group is always portrayed a certain way in the movies. You know, we've seen the Spring Breakers and we all expect them to be, you know, kind of party dudes, but these weren't necessarily party dudes. They were, you know, a group of friends that were together. And I think maybe if this had come from, you know, slightly different culture, it would have resonated with you, Rashmi, in particular, a slightly different way. But just a minor point, I just felt that, you know, if this was French cinema, we would totally get it.
Yeah, another way of saying it is that this is not a case of untalented people just saying, well, let's just go out and shoot some stuff and see what we can
correct,
make of it.
Correct. So, and that's these, not my that's right. not my intention. There is
there's a lot of purity. It might be misguided purity, but there is some degree of, you know, there's some degree of so clearly these are very talented people. The actors were very good, and a lot of it might have been improvised, but I don't know. There's something austere, and there is a sense of capturing a mood and a feeling. And I think 80% of the people, this movie will frustrate them.
Yeah.
I think it will frustrate 100% of the people, but I think it's not even, it's going to, it's trying to make you feel a particular kind of feeling. And
yeah.
I like, at the risk of repeating myself, it's only when I surrendered to it that I...
Yeah. I hate this stuff. Yeah. I absolutely hate this stuff. And
yeah, you like this and you didn't like Holy Motors.
I know, right?
WTF. Yeah.
When are we going to let go of Holy Motors?
You will never let go.
But yeah, this stuff doesn't work for me. But I think...
Also...
In some ways, you know, I did enjoy The Tree of Life. And I think I enjoyed it much more so than you, Rashmi, although you didn't hate that movie either.
No, I didn't
and
hate
it, in many ways, it has that... Like you say, you used a lovely expression when you reviewed Tree of Life on the podcast, which was, you know, you kind of have to sit back and just let it wash over you. Mm-hmm. You can't sit there and actively engage with a narrative.
Or try to connect, you know, A with B.
You just have to kind of let it pass over you in the way that it does. And this movie very much... had that same effect. Again, like you, Yesti, for 45 minutes, I was like, where are we going with this? And then I'm like, what the hell? I'm going to sit back and enjoy. And it worked brilliantly.
I'll admit it. I don't feel good about it, but I think I snoozed.
That's okay, but maybe it's supposed to give you the trance-like feeling.
The movie was doing its job.
You got a high without taking any
there
chemicals.
There you go. If you want a good rest, watch this movie. You'll close your eyes.
I've heard
and have
that,
a good snooze.
I've heard that people snooze sometimes when they do mushrooms. No, I'm kidding. I've never done mushrooms. For the record, I've never done psychedelics.
Also, I don't think this movie will be... a tenth as effective if it's watched on the small screen. It won't work at all. So I think it...
Yeah, for me, clearly, obviously didn't work on the big screen.
Just to kind of wrap up our Tribeca coverage, I mean, I think this may be difficult outside of a film festival context as well. I mean, you know, film festivals in many ways enable you to take a risk on something that you wouldn't ordinarily want to see, maybe something a little... less established in terms of directors, writers, and teams. Expectations for me, one of the fun parts of being fit at film festivals is that you literally go in oftentimes knowing nothing but the
and
title.
And no reviews, right? No reviews are there out there.
Yeah,
for you to help.
Certainly there's nothing on Rotten Tomatoes to kind of guide your selections here. So this movie is a great example of the kind of reason that we come to film festivals, the kind of reason
absolutely.
That you should go to film festivals if you're listening to this podcast, because it's a risk like this that can pay off, and pay off in a context that may not be as satisfying outside of the film festival setting.
Yeah, and I think they're often a showcase for particular actors or directors or cinematographers, and hopefully these are like their resumes. Okay, someone who's important is hopefully watching this group of people. And again, Joe, I completely agree with you. This is a talented group of people. Mm-hmm. For me, it just didn't work as a movie.
And, you know, I'm not suggesting, I know people who this is the only kind of film they watch and that this is the only kind of film they will say is true cinema. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying this is a very particular, very specific kind of cinema, and that's nowhere close to all that cinema should be. But I'm glad that this is also something cinema
there you
is,
go.
You know, once in a while. And remember when we were talking on day one about this movie I saw, which I was having a really hard time describing to you, which incidentally won, I think, Best First Director Award? It's a movie called Men Go to Battle, which is set during the Civil War era.
Yes.
And that movie did what this one did, is that it was very tactile and it set this mood and it made you feel like you had been breathing that air and being in that mental state as the characters were in that.
So I better not
movie.
Watch that one either.
So, so it wasn't interested in a plot necessarily. It just wanted you to be in that time frame feeling what those people were.
Sure.
So it's hard to do that. Okay.
Okay.
On that end of pretentious Tribeca. Note.
Yeah, well, this is the last of our formal podcasts coverage for the Tribeca Film Festival. So do check out the other episodes if you're coming in late and you haven't heard. We do tend to go on just a little bit in these ones, but it's just a reflection of how much we get out of these film festivals. And again, yeah, as movie wallows, we're nothing other than, you know, three people who are passionate about movies. We think that if you're taking the time to listen to our podcast, then you are too, and then these events need to be part of you know, the way that you spend your leisure time. I mean, this has been a fantastic film festival, and we haven't caught the half of it. I mean, literally, we've come in for 4 days of what is a 10 or 11 day film festival, and you know, guys, I mean, please, you owe it to yourselves to experience this.
And I think if nothing else, hopefully we've given you some ideas of getting some hold of some movies, and there are many ways to watch movie these days. There are, you know, we used to call it straight to video, but I mean, now with Netflix and Hulu and Amazon and HBO,
but there's
a lot of ways to get some of this content, and I hope that many of these will go
but we have to acknowledge that many of the movies that we're talking about on these set of podcasts are not going to see the light of day just because of the difficulties in distribution deals. Even with all of the outlets you're mentioning, Rashmi, you know, one of the things that I love about film festivals is that we see material here that we have no access to otherwise. And we're privileged because we get a lot of PR agencies and publicists contacting us, wanting us to review their smaller films, you know, in order to try and gain some publicity. So, you know, we have more access than most. And yet still some of these films would not have been accessible to us had we not attended.
Yeah.
And Come to film festivals.
And exactly. And not to geek out on film festivals, but honestly, I mean, I'm speaking within the specifics of Tribeca, and every film festival has its strengths and its weaknesses. But, you know, you can watch a movie like Anesthesia, which is so polished and so gleaming and has all these big name actors and is a fine, fine piece of very traditional filmmaking. And you can watch something as experimental as, you know, Down Came Molly or Come Down Molly.
Come Down Molly, yeah.
Come Down Molly.
Or something as provoking as Cartel Land.
Or Cartel Land. And my point is, if you do just a little bit of homework, no more than what you would do if you decide to watch any other movie and look in, you know, what's playing right now. I think of all the film festivals I've been to, maybe Tribeca might be the least fuss of all. Especially if you're in the New York area, there's a wonderful app. You can buy tickets. You can stand in rush line. And if you're in the first 30 or 40 people, you'll probably get in. The movies start on time. The director might be there. And you can pick, depending on your liking, what kind of movies you want to watch. Honestly, people need to. I mean, you really, if you like movies, cinema in any form, you're depriving yourself of a great experience if you don't go to film festivals.
So, guys, I don't know about you, but to end this New York experience, I'm looking at pictures of dumplings now.
Okay.
The belly has spoken. Yes.
Back to reality from a lofty.
That's right.
Idea.
And that's the other advantage.
Right.
If you are coming from out of town, you know, film festivals are a great excuse to visit a location, maybe check out some of the local cuisine. I mean, you know, we've had the fortune here of being in New York for a few days. We've been, you know, pretty much dedicated movie watchers here, but, you know, take a gap of time, come visit New York, maybe do it in parallel with the film festival, and you know, get some good eats in while you can as well. So, I mean, I guess to wrap up, which is rationally what you're trying to do here.
That's right.
We are 45 minutes into the podcast. You know, I'd very much like to, you know, just say a big thanks to everyone that organized Tribeca this year. I mean, I think there is an army of people out there that make this thing run like clockwork. The materials have been beautifully produced. I think the film festival is just, you know, it's one of the best organized, incredibly well run. Well,
and no QC issues, you know, no like, oh, sorry, it says 3 p.m. here, but it's actually 3:30. There's none of that.
Yeah.
Well, I did spot a typo in the book that had an X through it, but I'll forgive them for that.
Yeah.
At least they corrected it.
You know, everything runs very well. We're ushered around in a very controlled, panic-free, drama-free environment, considering some of the shepherding that they have to do. So, you know, props to the organizers. Thank you for letting us be a part of your film festival. We've really had a blast, and I hope all the Movie Wallers listeners that have had the patience to sit through these podcasts have enjoyed them too. We certainly enjoyed making them.
I so want to come back
them.
Next year.
Yeah.
So on that note, let us know what you think of these film festival coverages. We get a lot out of doing them. We do them, I think, because we think that there's an opportunity to expose some talent and also just give you insights on movies that you may not hear about elsewhere. So mail at moviewallers.com, twitter.com/moviewallers, facebook.com/moviewallers as well.
And soon Instagram.
And yeah, we did sign up for an Instagram account for Movie Wallers. So if you do use Instagram, check out there. We'll post things from time to time. We'll try and keep it movie related. So do follow us on Instagram. Until our next podcast, where it's kind of back to normal business, we've got a few other films to catch up on. So I know you're looking forward to hearing about some of those. Too many movies, too little time. A good night from me.
And me.
And me as well.
Thank you.